NICD Chat is a series of podcasts discussing important issues, encouraging both an open exchange of different views and constructive dialogue. The ultimate goal of NICD Chat is to provide a forum where civil discourse can occur on many pressing issues facing people today, in an effort to create solutions through facilitating respectful dialogue on often tough questions.
Iowa, South Carolina, Nevada, and New Hampshire have weighed in on their choices for the next president, and yesterday, voters in 12 states cast their votes on Super Tuesday. The campaigns are busy spinning the results, and in 2 weeks, voters in Missouri will go to the polls for their presidential primary, where millennials may, for the first time, cast the deciding votes. At the same time, President Obama has been stressing the need for civility, and the Senate looks like it won't do anything to fill the Supreme Court vacancy. Today, we are going to talk about these issues and probably a few more as we are joined by Louis Duguid, a member of the Kansas City Star's editorial board. Louis is a native of St. Louis and graduated from the University of Missouri Columbia School of Journalism. Right after graduation, he went to work for the Kansas City Star for what he thought would be a 2-year stint. He is also an author as well, having written Discovery, The Real America, Toward a More Perfect Union, and A Teacher's Cry, Expose the Truth About Education Today. He also has a new book coming out this year, Our Fathers, Raising Black Men, that examines the role of black businessmen played in post-World War II in helping to shape African-American boys into strong men. He is the recipient of over 60 awards for his work, and last year he was the winner of the 2015 Angela B. Henderson Community Services Award, given to journalists who have had a positive effect on community well beyond the normal journalism realm. Welcome, Louis, and thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, do you have any recent work that you would like to highlight?
Recent work on the whole issue of civility?
Yes.
I think that we're seeing the worst of what the presidential elections could possibly offer, with name-calling, finger-pointing, and so much other baser stuff, particularly going on in the Republican camp. I would like to see the candidates talk about the issue and the issues that really face this country, but we're not really hearing any of that.
Thank you. And now, as a member of the editorial board, you have the freedom to write on many things, unlike many reporters who generally have a beat covering specific issues. Monday, you wrote about presidential candidate Donald Trump finally backing away from positive comments made by David Duke, a former leader of the Ku Klux Klan. It's fair to say that everyone was a little shocked, if not feeling more so not in disbelief, that he said that he would need to do more study on the issue before he immediately renounced the support.
I think that you would have to be on another planet not to know David Duke and not to know the history of the Ku Klux Klan. And it's disappointing that Donald Trump, as the front runner in the Republican race for the presidential nomination, didn't immediately denounce the support that David Duke on his radio program gave to Trump. What Duke's endorsement, formal endorsement, but his kind words about Trump's candidacy really say is that there's an element out there in this country that doesn't like certain individuals who might be of a different color, a different ethnicity, from a different country, and that these people aren't included in their vision of what is America.
Thank you. And well, you also wrote that Trump has made it okay for the U.S. people to basically openly express their hatred, where they aren't categorized with just the David Dukes, but to make, I guess, hatred more mainstream, or and exclusion of people without money and power. Now, why do you think that Teflon Don, as you've called him, is able to get away with doing such things that would probably cause any other candidate to be pushed so far back in the race that he'd be in a different time zone?
Well, number one, and I've written a column on this, Donald Trump has an appeal with the American public that I think is largely tied to the fact that he's a billionaire. And he's someone who's been on television, reality, has his own reality TV show, and he has this celebrity and sort of the guy's rich, he must be smart, appeal to just everyday Americans that has allowed him to be able to defy political gravity, to continue to lead in the polls, and as we've seen from the Super Tuesday contest, to win most of the states.
Wow, yeah. It's an extreme version of if it bleeds, it leads, almost.
Well, I think it's a little deeper than that. There had been a study a few years ago about the unintended effect of the Archie Bunker TV series. When Norman Lear created Archie Bunker as a character in All in the Family, he wanted people to see the ridiculousness of people who harbored such hatred and ill feelings about African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, people who are Jewish, I mean, you, Catholics, you name it. Archie Bunker was America's favorite living room bigot. But what a study showed is that instead of Norman Lear intending to have people see this guy and laugh at him and turn away from that kind of bigotry, some did, and then the others went in the exact opposite direction. What Donald Trump has done is to give people who have this sort of underlying sentiment to feel like that. And so these kinds of blow-ups, whether it's with the Pope saying that Donald Trump, for wanting to build a wall, doesn't seem a Christian, it gives Trump the okay to even tell the Pope, you don't know what you're talking about.
Wow. Yeah, and I think the All in the Family reference was a great point, because I also remember distinctly Dave Chappelle, the comedian, speaking about that same point with his show, The Chappelle Show, feeling like he was no longer making a satirical joke and that the people were actually being encouraged and it was no longer satire, it was becoming reality. So I thought that was an interesting point, how it was intended to do one thing and actually cause the opposite effect.
Absolutely. And again, there were people who were cheering for Archie Bunker, the same as there are people now who are cheering for Donald Trump. Yeah. And it sanctions them to feel that it's okay to talk badly about other people, to think that they're not alone, that this is the American way, and that exclusion in the face of the increasing diversity in this country is the way things should be.
Wow. Well, now, speaking of the American way, a few weeks ago, President Obama returned to his political roots in the Illinois State House and gave a speech calling for more civility and compromise in our politics. He noted that, "I've always believed so deeply in a better kind of politics, in part based on his experiences in the state legislature." You wrote that the speech reminded you of Rodney King and his "Can't We All Just Get Along" plea in the midst of the riots in South Central Los Angeles in 1992, and you called for more people to raise their voices just as King did in order to break the gridlock and bring the country and elected officials back to their senses. What is your theory on how we got so far down this current road that some politicians have thrown common courtesy and any willingness to forge compromise out the window and are actually proud of the gridlock and their actions to produce, I guess, improductivity? So,
well, I'm going to kind of reference some articles that have been done on this subject. One I saw said that part of the problem is linked to the baby boomers. Baby boomers are now in their 50s and 60s, and for this year, baby boomers will become 70. And baby boomers were the me generation, the self-indulged generation, the offspring of the greatest generation, World War II folks, deciding that they were going to pamper their kids, unlike kids have been pampered before, and they did. And so baby boomers grew up with the sense of entitlement that I think we're seeing the outcome of that now in the politics, and that's that it's my way or not at all. The whole notion of sharing, the whole notion of caring, the whole notion of reaching across different lines to help one another seems to be a feeling of the past. Robert Putnam wrote about this in his book Bowling Alone, and he underscored the whole notion that the social capital that has been the glue for America has been diminishing since the start of the post-World War two years, and that's people getting together to talk, to share, to play cards, to watch TV, to have dinner, to have cookouts, have picnics, and so many of those little things actually add up to individuals valuing other individuals and what they can provide, or the sense that there can be some reciprocity down the road where one person will help another person if that person were only given the option of being helped today. And I think that the politics that we're seeing today and what's taking place in business and industry is showing this reduction in social capital having reached a critical level, so that it produces the political gridlock that we're seeing. But it also produces this huge disparity of wealth that is growing to record levels. We know from the history of this country that doesn't end well.
No, historically, we've always seen a tragic outcome in those kind of situations. But jumping back to the future, after speaking with baby boomers, or rather the now, millennials are now a key target in this election, and a number of stories have been written on the Sanders campaign's appeal to millennials, because it's taking on things like wealth disparity that we spoke on. It has big celebrity endorsements like the rapper and activist Killer Mike. Sanders is going on youth outlets like The Breakfast Club. It seems a little odd that a lot of the support for the 74-year-olds campaign is coming from the 17 to 29-year-olds. Now, with the Census Bureau noting that last year the millennials now outnumber baby boomers in Missouri, what kind of impact do you think they'll have on the election's outcome in the Show Me State this year?
Millennials outnumber baby boomers nationwide, and I think that what we'll see and what we're seeing right now is millennials are gravitating to someone like Bernie Sanders, and I've written about this as well. They're gravitating towards Sanders because he's promising things that they see lacking in their lives today. They don't see opportunities. The opportunities that baby boomers and the greatest generation had, millennials aren't seeing for themselves. They're struggling to make it. They're being saddled with student loans, mostly because states and other governments have reduced the funding that they provided for young people to go to college. So families are having to absorb that more. But families are struggling and haven't really seen their net income increase since 1970. So the millennials are just up against the wall. They are really attracted to Bernie Sanders asking for Medicare for all. that type of universal health care program. They're attracted to free college tuition. They're attracted to saying, to heck with the minimum wage, let's get a living wage. And they should be, because, you know, these are things that had been almost an expectation for previous generations, and right now baby boomers are sort of reaching the end of their more productive years, and millennials are supposed to be really plugging in, taking charge, and doing some fabulous things. But this is a generation that is struggling to get traction in the work world and in social and civic endeavors, not unlike what took place during the Great Depression, when young people during the Great Depression really struggled to find jobs, and then to find decent paying jobs, and then to be able to get into college and not be on breadlines. And so Sanders is addressing that, and I think that the other candidates need to do the same.
Well, thank you. Now, in regards to what has happened in recent news with the Supreme Court, the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia has left a vacancy on the court, as we've all seen. And the response from the Senate Republicans, with the notable exception of very few, was to write a new chapter in the Senate Book of Dysfunction. You know, the one after do nothing and can't get right is...
And don't forget to shut the government down.
Oh, that's, you know, I think that's a chapter they reference often. But they've been announcing that they would not hold a hearing nor take a vote on a nominee that hasn't yet even been named. They used a lot of lame duck, not in an election year sound bites that we've all heard before. But there's no precedent for their action, and they're hindering the court's ability to do its job, as there are 9 members on the court to ensure there will not be a tie. What's your sense of the public's response to this preemptive gridlock approach?
I think that Republicans who have been calling for Obama to not send a candidate to the Senate are grandstanding. This is a political ploy, and they're trying to get the people to side with them, thinking that people will go along with Obama not doing his job. And I've written a column on this too, saying that the Republicans have accused Obama of going too far when it comes to gun control, stretching the executive rules, when it comes to health care, when it comes to, you know, so many different things. But now, on an issue where the Constitution is very clear on what the president wants or should be doing, they want to say, well, wait a minute, we don't want you to do that. And that's just ludicrous. What I think it's grandstanding completely, because if the Senate does this sort of stonewalling and they take it right into a time when the Senate goes into recess, well, the president, because there has to be a workaround of the political gridlock, can do a recess appointment and put someone on the court that way. So it's just silly that the Republicans would do this, because here again, there's a workaround. Now, Obama has said that he doesn't want to do a recess appointment because he would like for his choice to be washed through the Senate confirmation process, which is good, because then people can see whether or not this is a good candidate. Given gridlock, he's got options.
Yeah. Wow. And I think that points to, you know, the bigger issue of the change in incivility, or just the unwillingness to work across the aisle, or even not even across the aisle, just within the same party. So how would you describe the change in tone in American politics over the years? And what's your advice to those of us who are working towards a more civil society and more civility in politics? And I know it might sound crazy, I did use the word civility and politics in the same sentence, but that is not a mistake.
No, I appreciate you're doing that. I think that It's important for people to understand that this is the way things get done. It is possible for people, Republicans and Democrats, to disagree. That goes back as far as politics in this country has existed. Tip O'Neill, who was the House Speaker, and President Ronald Reagan, they didn't agree on much, but at the end of the day, they compromised and got legislation passed. That same sort of can-do effort needs to occur again. Representative Emanuel Cleaver, who's from the Kansas City area, has made many, many efforts to bring civility to the House, and I think that there needs to be a coalescing around Representative Cleaver to help this to get traction so that the gridlock ends.
NICD Chat is a series of podcasts discussing important issues, encouraging both an open exchange of different views and constructive dialogue. The ultimate goal of NICD Chat is to provide a forum where civil discourse can occur on many pressing issues facing people today, in an effort to create solutions through facilitating respectful dialogue on often tough questions.
We are joined by Louis Duguid, a member of the Kansas City Star's editorial board. Louis is a native of St. Louis and graduated from the University of Missouri Columbia School of Journalism. Right after graduation, he went to work for the Kansas City Star for what he thought would be a two-year stint. He is also an author as well, having written Discovering the Real America, Toward a More Perfect Union, and A Teacher's Cry, Expose the Truth About Education Today. He also has a new book coming out this year, Our Fathers, Raising Black Men, that examines the role of black businessmen played in post-World War II in helping to shape African-American boys into strong men. He is the recipient of over 60 awards for his work, and last year he was the winner of the 2015 Angela B. Henderson Community Services Award, given to journalists who have had a positive effect on community well beyond the normal journalism realm. Welcome, Louis, and thank you so much for joining us today. Now, Louis, you are a graduate of the University of Missouri Columbia School of Journalism, the site of student protests, including a hunger strike and black football players refusing to play due to racism on the campus. Their efforts resulted in the resignation of the school's president, and we are all sadly familiar with the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, which in August 2014 erupted in protest and violence after the August 9, 2014 police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown. That led to the creation and the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement, bringing badly needed attention to the killings of young black males by white police officers. This past January, you wrote a column, Young Black Activists Make the U.S. Better, and noted that, like King's generation, today's students won't tolerate the status quo. And good for them. If black lives are to matter, then the voices of young African Americans have to be heard and result in meaningful change. Clearly, we all need to speak out if we are to relegate the status quo to history. And what is your advice on the steps that can be taken to kind of end this status quo of institutional racism at every level of society in America and the world, which I know you've written about as well?
Sure. I think that young people today, who are college students in particular, need to study the activism that really marked the 50s and the 60s, whether it was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Leading the civil rights movement, or Rosa Parks getting things started, or looking at some of the efforts that were really rooted to students during the protests against the Vietnam War. It's those things that are really critical, because they led to so much change. We have the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we have the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and so many other meaningful pieces of legislation that really benefited people. But then the Civil Rights Movement gave rise to the American Indian Movement, to the Chicano Movement, to the Women's Movement, and it's that kind of, I think, energy that really is on the ground and ready to take hold here in this country again. It's good that young people on college campuses are seeing that they have an agency in making this happen, and it's good that people who are in power are responding in a very meaningful way. And I've heard and seen where some legislators, Missouri being one of the places where legislators have made some pretty vile statements, where they just want to go in and do like a bunch of arrests and knock heads and put down any protest effort. Well, that's the wrong approach. And I think that working with young people to, again, ensure that meaningful change takes place is the key. And really, another piece of this is making sure that young people see that they have a future, because so many people who are millennials feel that they don't have a way to kind of make a life for themselves. They don't see that they have a future going forward, and that's a problem. We have to get past that.
Wow, thank you. And I'm glad that you spoke about the inclusion of other movements, because I believe the inclusion of the different types of movements that have kind of gained more traction, energy after the explosion of the Black Lives Movement, Black Lives Matter movement, was shown really at the Justice or Else rally last year, where you saw members representing the Hispanic population, the LGBT community, the First Nations community, and really all different religions and creeds were included at that rally for the focus that you were just speaking about, like kind of making sure that there is a future where all voices are heard. And
yes.
And also, in relation to that, I know that you've written extensively on diversity in media and diversity in Hollywood specifically, and especially in light of the Oscars taking place last weekend, where we had a lot of discussion about the lack of inclusion of several titles. And there was a piece that came out in the New York Times last week, which highlighted the stories and narratives of several creators and creatives in Hollywood, titled "What Is It Really Like to Work in Hollywood If You Are Not a Straight White Man?" by Melina Rising. And it was really enlightening to show the disparity of unique and different voices in actually the business of telling different narratives. So I wanted to know, what was your take on the Oscars, and how can we build a more inclusive media world or media ecosystem?
Media ecosystem, I like that. Number one, I think that the Oscars are simply indicative of a larger problem in this country, and that's a lack of acceptance of the increasing diversity in the United States. We have a population that is more than 50% women. We have a population that is 19% Latino. We have a population that is 14% African American, 5% Asian American, and yet we don't see representative numbers in any of these areas when it comes to positions in corporations, on board of directors, on in positions of power, elected offices, and that's huge. So to me, the Academy Awards is just indicative of an unwillingness of the country to be inclusive, and the Academy Awards fortunately is taking steps to try to make it possible for an equity to exist in who gets named for what awards. And a nomination doesn't mean a person wins, it's just a nomination. But if you don't get nominated, if you don't get recognized, then you're lost, you're done. And so what they're trying to do in reconfiguring the process is to make it possible for people of color to surface so that they can at least have a shot.
Yeah, representation is terribly important. And that brings me to another issue. And there was actually a conference about Black Twitter and the power of social media held by the National Association of Black Journalists in New York City last week. And that also brings to mind the issue of representation and inclusion, as there are a number of instances of people of various ethnic backgrounds furthering the culture, the online culture, but really having corporations profit off of their material without giving them just due or credit. And a piece that comes to mind specifically for me is a piece that was written by Doreen St. Felix in The Fader, and it was talking about how Black teens are breaking the internet and seeing none of the profits from corporations, as in the corporations are using the memes, using the internet culture that we're seeing created and perpetuated, but the creators are being left out, which is a familiar narrative we've heard time and time again. So I wanted to hear your thoughts, one on the opportunities that the online media and that world offers in representing and having diverse views heard, and what your thoughts are on those voices still being excluded, but their material being usurped.
Okay, I've written about the Black Twitter Conference. I'm the newsletter editor for the Kansas City Association of Black Journalists, and I wanted to make sure that people had the option to be able to take part in that. And I think it's so vitally important for that conversation to occur now, as people are seeing that that there is a way for people to use the internet for business purposes. And the intellectual property rights is huge. This is something that has affected African Americans and other people of color forever, having their intellectual property stolen by larger conglomerates. It's almost like taking candy from a baby, as my dad used to say, and he was a PhD chemist and lost many different formulas to larger corporations. And I think that we have to think about ways in which we can protect our property rights, but not keep it so close that we lose the opportunity to take advantage of or to capitalize on the uniqueness that the people of color provide. Going back to the issue of the Academy Awards and nominations, it's so important that it's not just about numbers, it's not just about filling a quota, but the people have to see that there's great value in what the folks who've largely been overlooked can bring to the whole table of America, to enlarge the the marketplace and enlarge the whole idea forum so that with more ideas from more and more creative people, we can make better choices. And with those better choices, we can continue to be a world leader.
Wow. Thank you so much, Lewis. This has been a true wonder speaking with you today, and we definitely would love to have you on NICD Chat again. So thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.